Hey, this is Dave Infante. Welcome to Vine Pairs Tap Lines, a weekly interview series with brewing icons, industry insiders, and outspoken experts about the United States' most beloved and best-selling beers. It's modern American history, one beer at a time. What does the acronym BA mean to you, Tap Lines listener? To a lot of beer enthusiasts, it means one of two things: the Brewers Association, or Barrel Aged. And with respect to the fine folks at the craft brewing industry's largest trade group out in Boulder, Colorado, this episode ain't about them. Barrel aging beer is old hat these days, midway through the roaring and or terrible 20s, but that wasn't always so. In fact, the mainstream rise of barrel aging and the BA stouts that the process was and is mostly known for dates back to the relatively recent past of just 30 years ago, and of now famous tete-a-tete in South Bend, Indiana, between the brewers of a certain Chicago craft brewery called Goose Island and the late Booker No, the legendary scion and master distiller of the Beam Bourbon Dynasty. Joining Tap Lines today to put you at that spirited, cigar smoke-laced Hoosier State Summit that birthed the craft brewing industry's barrel-aging experiment in earnest is Seth Gross, who is then a brewer at Goose Island. We talked about how he, Noe, and Goose Island scion and brewmaster Greg Hall first came up with the idea to barrel-age a beer, how they did it, and what happened next once rank-and-file drinkers got their hands on the final product. Some three decades later, Gross is still barrel-aging his own beers at Durham, North Carolina's Bull City Burger and Brewery. Just one of the hundreds, or more likely thousands, of brewers who have taken up the BA gospel since. It's Bull City Burger and Brewery's Seth Gross, it's barrel-aged stout, it's the beginning of Goose Island's game-changing barrel-aging program, and it's all right here, right now, on Vine Pairs Tap Lines. Welcome back, Tap Lines listeners. We're joined here in the virtual studio by Seth Gross. Seth, welcome to Tap Lines, my man.
Howdy.
Thanks so much for joining us. Where are you joining us from, Seth?
I am in Durham, North Carolina.
Nice. Just down the road from Tap Lines' physical HQ here in Richmond, Virginia. We're on the Tobacco Belt, the Tobacco Road, I suppose it's called, yep, more accurately. Good to have another mid-Atlantic-ish, sure, semi-southern guest here on Tap Lines. Listener, you're well familiar in, you know, 2023, 2024, of the idea of barrel aging beers. You know, this is a thing. It's very well established. You know, even people who aren't that into craft beer have probably stumbled across, a Goose Island Bourbon County Stout, maybe on a case or on a pallet in their local Costco. It's penetrated the market to the point where the rank and file, the normies, have gotten into it. It wasn't always that way. And Seth, you're joining us today to talk a little bit about how that came to be and in a key moment, a key turning point in the rise of American barrel-aged beers in the craft beer segment. Seth, we have what I like to refer to as hokily as possible as the Tap Lines time machine. We like our guests to pick a year when, you know, they think it's the right time to sort of start the story that we're going to be talking about today. If I handed over the time machine to you for you to steer, when would you take us back to?
Early 90s.
Okay.
You know, I had just kind of gotten to Chicago, and I had graduated cooking school into the Culinary Institute of New York, CIA. And I also had a microbiology degree, and my plan was to cook. Mm. But, you know, I arrived in Chicago, and I was cooking. I was working at a couple of really, really fine dining places. And that's when I kind of stumbled into Goose Island on Clybourne, into the pub there, the original location, and met Greg, and everything changed at that point.
What was the pub like at that time? I mean, obviously, listeners these days, you know, we have a whole generation of craft beer drinkers who aren't aware of those heady earlier days of the first wave. What did Goose Island look like back then in the early 90s?
It was really cool because it was this sort of dark wood tone English pub vibe. You know, I was in my early 20s. I didn't know a lot about beer. I mean, this is just sort of the first rise of craft beer in the United States, and then eventually kind of fall, and now we're in that second peak, and
sure,
arguably, you know, maybe in the second fall. But more importantly, early 90s, you know, you come into Goose Island, it was big, packed with people, olds, kind of dark woods, had that square bar in the middle, and very much had that English pub kind of feel to it. And I didn't know a lot about beer, but I tried like the Honker's Ale, and I was like, wow, this beer's really good. I didn't know a ton. I knew the basics of what's in beer, but you know, it really was a great place to learn and be educated about beer.
When did you start brewing with Goose Island?
Yeah, so this is one
of those,
like, you're
still cooking at that point, right?
Yeah. I'm working in kitchens. I was at Ombria in Chicago and at Charlie Trotter's. And so, you know, it was one of those like serendipitous things where I came in and one day I kind of meet Greg, and Greg's a real hardcore foodie. If you don't know that, like he's really into food as much as his beer. And so he found out I was cooking and I was working in these nice restaurants. So it got to like, I would come in on a day off and he would see me and say like, hey man, like teach me about this sauce. Like, what are the ingredients in that? And how do you make, when I was there, I ate this, how do you do that? And I was saying, well, like, what is a English bitter? And like, what makes a stout? And, you know, we're kind of picking each other's brains. And we developed a friendship over kind of food and beer that way. And so that was going pretty good. And then one day I came in and he said, you know, my assistant is leaving. And I think you have a great background. You ever thought about brewing beer? Now, I was young, I was dumb, but I was smart enough to say, the beer here is good. And I keep seeing people come in and like interview Greg and like talk about the beers. And, you know, it's like this whole renaissance was happening in craft beer. And I said, geez, you know, I really want to cook, but this is probably a really good opportunity that a lot of people would want. I mean, I would be having lunch with them and two people would walk in with their resumes, you know, hands trembling, like, Mr. Hall, would you look at my resume? I'd like to brew beer here. And here he is asking me, like, do you want to brew beer? And I thought, well, yeah, sure. It helped that I had a microbiology degree. I never wanted to use it. I just want to make my parents happy. So I got that degree. So I knew a bit about yeast and things like that. I mean, I had basics and I understood chemistry pretty well. And it just kind of fell into place that a degree I never thought I'd use actually ended up using to some level, you know, working with yeast and microscopes and things like that. But he really taught me about brewing beer. I had maybe homebrewed with a friend maybe once or twice, but I didn't want to do that because it didn't taste as good as like what I got at sure. brew pubs at that time. So, you know, professional sure. brewing was for me, and that's how it all started.
How do you remember the year like that you actually came on as a staffer?
92, 93, somewhere in there.
So we're still like early 90s here.
Yeah.
Describe, you mentioned it just a little bit, but like describe the craft beer sort of landscape at that time, not in Chicago so much, but just like in general, what did the marketplace look like?
So it was just kind of taken off. And I mean, you had the founding, you know, the fathers of all this with Sierra Nevada and Ken Grossman, and, you know, getting to meet guys like Ken coming into the pub. That's the kind of place Goose Island was, that you had beer, right? I got to meet Michael Jackson several times, wow. you know, coming in to, and it was really like a cool place to be. And so you had Anchor, you had Sierra Nevada, and then there were a handful of other kind of breweries getting going at that time in the early 90s, and things were really just starting to take off. And I got to see that kind of rise of craft beer where the public was so uneducated in a way about beer. You know, your choices were the commercial light lagers or one of these like startup craft beers, but people weren't well educated. And so the joke back then was every doctor or dentist would want to open up. And so we saw these little brew pubs starting to open up, and it was almost without fail that it was somebody who, like a doctor or a dentist who had money and was like, hey, I'm going to start a brew pub. And we had a lot of really mediocre beer coming out of those places, you know? And so Goose Island really stood out because the quality was exceptional.
Yeah. So one of the things that Goose Island would go on to, you know, as I mentioned earlier, would go on to be known for, well, I suppose infamously they're known for being acquired by Anheuser-Busch in 2011 and sort of kicking, they're the ones that were the first to sell to well, the not technically the first, but of that shopping spree that ABI went on last decade, yeah. They were the first big acquisition. But the other thing they're known for, maybe a little bit more happily and less controversially these days, is they're synonymous. The brand is synonymous with barrel aging beer. As right. I mentioned moments ago, listener, that wasn't always the case. Seth, you happen to, by serendipity and your fortuitous relationship with Greg Hall and your microbiology degree that you didn't even want, you happened to find yourself at the right place at the right time to witness
yeah.
what, I mean, I would argue is one of, if not the most important inciting incidents in American craft brewing's like barrel aging obsession that would come to be a decade later. Tell us a mm-hmm. little bit about yeah. your relationship to the barrel aging program. And, you know, maybe before even that, tell us a little bit about how it began.
Yeah. So this is another one of those stories where it just sort of right place at the right time. So at Goose Island, they were known for brewing, you know, authentic and true to style beer. So you could go in and get a true English bitter. You could get an English IPA, you know, Russian stout, whatever it may be. But at that time in craft beer, you weren't looking to do things that were, you know, suddenly we're going to put kiwi and sun-dried tomato in a beer. And, you know, we're going to, you know, put all these raspberry fruit yeah. or whatever in.
Marshmallow porter. What?
Yeah, yeah, exactly. So being very traditional, and, you know, Greg is a really cerebral guy, and he's very, very intelligent about beer, and, you know, just learning from him was a real opportunity. But every now and then, it's hard to know, like, when you're around someone like that, that if they say something sort of on a whim, and or there was a lot of thought and it had been building up and it really, you know, kind of came out. So early 90s, very hip to do these cigar bourbon beer dinners. Like, they were happening all the time. I mean,
yeah.
I can't remember the last time I even heard of someone doing one, but at that time, this is what you did, right?
And so it sounds very of the era. Yeah.
Oh, yeah, yeah. There was this LaSalle Grill in Indiana, not too far from Chicago. And so they were going to do one of these bourbon beer dinners, and they were going to do it with Booker No. And so, you know, I knew Booker's bourbon and I thought this was really cool. And so Greg and I went to this dinner and I'm a young kid. I'm just sort of Greg's sidekick here. You know, it was like, I was the guy who's like going to carry all the growlers in because Greg isn't going to do that. You know, I'm going to, you know, bring kegs of beer in, six stoles, whatever it is. Anyway, so we have this great, amazing dinner, really great. And we're sitting at the table with Booker No and all that. And so now it's after dinner and the place is kind of cleared out. But, you know, those of us who are sort of invited guests and all, we're sitting around the table and the cigars are lit and people are enjoying bourbon and drinking beer and telling war stories and what have you. And Greg, in his very Greg way, just sort of says, so, you know, what do you do with the barrels? Since you can only use them once for bourbon, they have to be new barrels. What are you doing with them? And so Booker starts explaining how we ship them to here and there and what happens. And Greg very offhandedly says sort of out loud, I wonder what it'd be like to age a beer in one of those bourbon barrels, you know? Because Booker was telling stories about how after they empty a barrel, like the yard workers, a very typical thing to do is they'll put a couple gallons of spring water in an empty barrel and roll it around the yard for the day. And then at the end of the day, once they're done working, you drain the barrel into tall glasses with ice in them and you have like watered down bourbon. They would call it like, you know, bourbon tea, like iced tea. And they would drink at the end of the day. And so we knew that there was bourbon in the wood and it would come out and, you know, how would that taste in a beer and what have you. So anyway, go back home. I'm in the brewery. It's maybe 2-3 weeks later. And at the loading dock door there. So this is just Clybourne Brew Pub to kind of also set the stage. Back then, there's just Goose Island. It's just a brew pub. There's no bottling. There's no grand ideas about we're going to build another plant. You know, it's a 10-barrel JV Northwest system, and we're making beer there. And anyway, so knock on this door, and it's a UPS driver. He says, I got a delivery here. And I'm thinking, well, we didn't order grain. I didn't, like, what could it be? And he rolls this giant whiskey barrel up to the door, and it's like all saran wrapped. Right. It's not it's in a box with packing peanuts or something. And I'm looking at this thing and there's a little card attached to it. And it was handwritten from Booker No. I hope Greg still has that. Anyway, and it says, hey, you know, great dinner. Thank you very much. Here's a barrel. Have fun kind of thing. Like, good luck with it. Mm-hmm. You know, hope you make something. So I call Greg and I'm like, hey, we've got an empty bourbon barrel, you know? And he's like, what are you talking about? And so we're looking at this thing and you know, you kind of rolling around, you can hear a little bit of liquid in there. And, you know, it's in the, coming out of the pores of the wood is still some bourbon. And so now we're petrified and terrified because we're thinking we've got a whiskey barrel with like a spirit in it. And this is pre-9/11. So this is still the, you know, the ATF. And like, what if an inspector comes and like, we have whiskey in the brewery and we're not a distillery. And like, we're anyway, so
officer, so I swear it's not ours. Yeah.
Right. Right.
We didn't have the UPS guy just dropped it off. Yeah.
So we hit this barrel and he started, you know, coming in and thinking about it. And he said, well, let's put a stout into it. And, you know, those flavors would marry well with the caramel and the vanilla of the oak and bourbon. And so we brewed a Russian Imperial Stout, except like we just kept adding grain and grain and grain until it was like starting to run out of the door, the top of the mash tun. Right. And so trying to stir this thing was like, I'm in there, you know, it's like a beast trying to stir thousands of pounds of grain in this 10 barrel, you know, mash tun. Anyway, so we brewed a really high gravity stout, filled it up in the fermenter. The thing took off and went like crazy. So, you know, you've got your blow off hose and came in the next day and it was like, you know, it was like a, I don't know, it was a Brady Bunch or Lucy where like, the suds are running out of, you know, out of the hose, like come in and the floor is covered in foam. And you're like, oh my God, did a tank explode? We realize it is fermenting so hard that it's just spewing foam. It's like Willy Wonka, like foam is just coming out of this thing. It dropped down. The fermentation ended. We had this nice rich stout and we filled up the whiskey barrel. And then we hid it underneath the stairs that there was like a storage crawl space that actually went under the bar. And so we hid it in there because now we knew we were like fortifying the beer basically because we knew there was some alcohol in the wood. And we just let it go and just let it sit there. And that's how it was born. And so Greg then filled up a few growlers and took it out to, I think it was the GABF at that time where he first took it. And we didn't really want to enter it in a category. There wasn't a category. There wasn't like a bourbon barrel age category. But I remember I didn't go, but he came back and he said, you know, I poured it for some press people and friends and whatever. I was like, hey, what do you think of this? And like people's minds exploded. Like, this is so good. It was like coconut and chocolate and vanilla and caramel and just, it was amazing. And he said, people really liked it. And I was like, all right. So we put it on tap and just hoped that it would like kind of go away before anybody knew that we had put this on tap. Any legal authorities. And that's how it launched. That was the very first batch of Bourbon County Stout.
How long was it in the barrel?
Yeah, I knew that question was coming. I'm trying to remember. I want to say maybe 4 months, but
yeah,
I should ask Greg that. Yeah, I'm thinking so that's this was about like, what it was.
Because the dinner happened maybe 93, 94. Is where Jeff Allworth at Beervana puts it. Yeah, yeah. Okay. Yeah. So maybe it's the beer is being served 94 or 95-ish, 4 months or so or whatever, you know, like somewhere thereabouts or even earlier, you think?
I think a little earlier than that. Yeah, I'm thinking 93, 94.
Okay.
Tops, yeah.
No one else was doing this at the time, right? I mean, by many accounts, including
truly revolutionary.
Yeah. No one had really done this before. How did Greg know, did you guys talk about what kind of, I mean, obviously it seems very intuitive these days to put a stout in a bourbon barrel, but no one had ever done it before.
Yeah.
You know, Jeff Allworth over at Beervana, who's been, you know, blogging about the industry for years, he makes the point that, you know, here, I'm going to quote here. The beer he chose was an Imperial Stout. Decades later, we know that Stout goes with bourbon like cherries go with Lambic, but at the time, Hall and his brewers were just taking a guess. Imagine if they put a pale ale in there. That's what Jeff Allworth wrote over at Beervana. Right. How did you guys know? I mean, again, it seems very intuitive these days. Dark beer, bourbon, you know, barrel, oh, that's going to gel together in a really nice finish. You only had one barrel. You could only put one batch of beer in there. Well, how did you know?
Yeah, it was a one and done.
Yeah.
We didn't. I remember the thought process was this, that it was like, well, you know, like that dark roasted character could be good with vanilla. I mean, people were doing like stout milkshakes and stuff like that. But I think I think the biggest reason for picking the stout, though, was Greg said, like, this is probably going to go sour and bad because we're putting it in a wood barrel that we were not sanitizing. I mean, granted, there's some alcohol in it, but I mean, this thing was in a rick house and is, you know, driven to us on a UPS truck. And, you know, who knows what bacteria is probably growing in there. So we're probably not going to get to drink the beer ever. And so let's just brew something really high alcohol and cross our fingers and hope it works. I think that was the majority of the thinking behind it. And so it was like, just how high alcohol can we get this beer to put it in? Were there Imperial Stouts back? I don't know when that became like even a term, you know, to use
BJCP style. I don't know when it came on. We had listener, if you're interested, we spoke with Sam Caligione of Dogfish Head, about the first ever Imperial, the first one that was ever registered with the TTB, you know, for labeling. And you can go back and find that episode. I don't know, Seth, when Imperial Stout. Yeah, I should know. Shame on me. But okay. So you guys brew the beer. It plays well at GABF, at the Great American Beer Festival. You come back, you put it on tap, the rest of it on tap. It moves at the Clybourne Pub. What happens next? Like, what's, you guys know that this is good. You like it. It's interesting, but it's not something that, well, before we get to what happens next, tell us a little bit about what, like, where this fits in or maybe doesn't with what people are drinking then. I mean, you described this idea that at that era or during that era of craft brewing, there was a lot of emphasis being placed on kind of reverse engineering traditional styles, right? And this was kind of like, we gotta get away from light adjunct lagers. There's this whole, you know, sort of, well, let's go execute well on European beers. This is not that. This is something else.
Right. Yeah. It was truly revolutionary because, you know, at that time it was all about, you must obey the Reinheitsgebot. You must, you know, like, you're going to look up the style guideline and like adhere to that. Because that was what good beer was. And if you didn't, you know, people would make fun of like, oh, did you see their porter? It's a little bit light or it's a little too dark. And that was, you know, like, people were like critical of that. And today, like, you know, you've got light porters, dark porters, and everyone just accepts that. But it was really adhering to those things. So now here we are, we're brewing all these different beers, but we introduced something that's got wood flavor to it and is in a style that no one knows how to describe. And so I don't even think, we were not calling it at the time anyway, Bourbon County Stout. I mean, that, I think marketing got into there somewhere and, you know, some people are like, we really need to give this a name. I think we just call it Barrel Aged Stout at the time.
Yeah.
You know, something very simple because there wasn't a thing.
And well, you guys so it weren't did even bottling fit in at that point.
Anyway. Oh no.
Yeah. So there was no release.
You could only
come
in and get a pint.
Right.
A pint. I think it's probably a snifter because it was so high alcohol, but, it was just one of those things. Like it was probably going to be a one and done if it was even drinkable and it turned out to be great. And I think the next problem was like, okay, how do we replicate that? And like, how do we get more barrels? Like today there's companies that this is their business is selling used bourbon barrels to breweries, right?
Yep.
Back then there wasn't like, hey, call up the guys and just tell them we need four more barrels. It just wasn't like that, you know? And so now we had to figure out how are we going to get more barrels and do we want to do this again? And like, what about the legalities of it as the word gets out? What if we get inspected or an agent shows up and says, hey, like, what exactly are you doing here? So there was,
What do you think you guys are up to here, man?
right.
Well, let's talk a little bit more about the barrels, if we could. Yeah. I mean, you mentioned, you know, this sort of pivotal or fortuitous, you know, dinner that you lucked out, you know, to be a part of. And then also that, you know, Booker No and Greg Hall, the meeting of the minds here, so to speak, that you get to witness. Booker No, listeners, for those who aren't in the know, is, I think he passed away a few years ago, I suppose, or maybe longer. But he was the grandson of Jim Beam, the Jim Beam. Yes. He was in the Jim Beam family at the very least. Yep. He was the master distiller at Jim Beam. Mm-hmm. So he's a guy to know in bourbon. That's why he's UPS trucking bourbon barrels to folks in Chicago. He's got the means, so to speak. So did you guys go back to Booker? Like, how do you secure more barrels?
Yeah, that was all Greg, you know, kind of working that out. But I, you know, I'm sure that's probably what he did is,
yeah,
you know, I mean, it's not like we had a whole bunch of guys that we knew and, you know, making bourbon. We knew one. So call that guy again and say, hey, this was actually pretty good. Can we get some more? And I think that's how it launched.
Yeah. Yeah. So, yeah. So you mentioned sort of some of the legal considerations. You're, you know, worried about securing barrels. But it's obviously popular enough that you got to do it again, right? So
right.
How does the program evolve from that first year while you're at Goose Island?
So in those early years, it was still kind of one barrel at a time. It wasn't like mm-hmm. today where they have, you know, huge barrel facilities. So I was lucky enough to be at Goose Island to watch like Fulton get built and, you know, them to go from a brew pub to, you know, a regional and the national
production
brand.
And
it was cool for me because I got to stay at the brew pub and, you know, I kind of had my choice at one point. And I, again, dumb enough, smart enough to thinking, well, if I go over to the big production facility, they're going to make like four things and I'm going to stay here and I'm still going to get to brew like 40 different beers.
Yeah,
You know, and so it was just for me, I'm going to stay at the brew pub and keep doing that.
Yeah.
So, you know, I think once that was built and then, you know, Honker's Ale was in packaged and all those other things, that's when, you know, Bourbon County Stout really was taking off and they realized we can't just keep doing one barrel at a time. We need to go to a much bigger thing. And that was all done, you know, away from the brew pub. So I wasn't involved at that point. Yeah, it was cool.
Yeah. When did they build Fulton?
Oh my gosh, I should know this. 96, 97, something
okay,
like that.
Okay, so you, it's like later on in that same decade, though,
yeah.
Thereabouts.
Yeah,
gotcha. What was the rotation that Goose Island was selling best when you were there? I mean, you mentioned Honker's Ale, obviously. Was 312 Urban Wheat around at that point or not yet?
Well, we did a lot of wheat beers, but I don't know. It wasn't called 312 at that time.
Gotcha, it's just, gotcha.
Know, wheat beers, yeah.
What else were people drinking? Yeah.
Oh, I mean, you know, a lot of classic English beers. I mean, that was really, you know, Greg loved those things. So doing ESBs and bit ordinary bitters and things like that. We did Pilsners. We did some lagers, things along those lines. You know, back then there was only one IPA and that was, you know, doing a British style IPA. And I think, right. I want to say it was, someone can look this up, but if you go and look at the Goose Island won the first time they won an IPA gold medal at the GABF. I want to say 95 maybe. And that was actually my recipe that, you know, Greg was great. He was such a great mentor. And I remember that year he said, you know, we're getting ready to brew that fall an IPA. And I was like, hey, I've got a couple ideas about changing some of the hop profile a little bit. And I want to, and he was like, yeah, man, go for it. Like, because you didn't have to be so consistent, like a packaged product, like they would today, they would never do that. But it was sort of like, yeah, why don't you take a swing at this one, you know? And so he let me do it and we sent it out and, you know, got a gold medal that year.
Wow.
That was kind of a cool thing. Yeah. And, the Hex Nut Brown Ale was something that I did. And that became a packaged product at Fulton as well. I believe they don't make that anymore, but
yeah, that doesn't ring a bell to me, honestly. Yeah,
you don't know the Hex Nut? Yeah, that's another good story.
I don't know
if you want to hear it now, but it's
not
a barrel story. So okay, so that was I totally screwed up in the brewery, and we were brewing our what were we brewing? I think we were brewing like a Dunkelweizen, something like that. And I kind of messed up. You know, early morning malts were not right. You know, I was off. Anyway, brew the beer, and I realize it, like, after we pitched the yeast, I was like, oh, shoot, man, I really screwed this up. So I go to Greg and kind of have my head down and like, hey, man, I messed up on the Dunkelweizen. And he's like, well, you know, we'll let it ferment out, see what it is tomorrow. We'll have to brew the Dunkel again. So when it was getting ready to come on tap, I remember this distinctly. Greg was going away for the weekend. I had to filter it on, like, a Friday morning, and he said, why don't you name it and just put it on tap? And whatever, you know, and I'm tasting it and I'm filtering it and I'm thinking, this is pretty good nut brown ale. And I thought, since I kind of messed it up, it was like a curse. So I called it a Hex Nut Brown Ale. And, you know, I got a full 10 barrel filtration and we put it on tap. And I remember we had a chalkboard and one of the bartenders, she was like really artistic and she drew like a hex nut and said like new beer on tap, Hex Nut Brown Ale. Well, it was like a 3-day weekend. Greg comes back on Tuesday. And he looks at the bright tank and there's only like 4 barrels out of 10 in there. And he goes, man, what happened with the filtration? Did it not go well? And I was like, no, it went great. Got 10 barrels. You know, he's like, well, what happened to the beer? I'm like, it sold. Yeah. And he's like, I don't, you know, there's no way you sold like 5-6 barrels in a weekend. I'm like, no, it did. And yeah, he went up and pulled the numbers and whatever. And so he was like, we're brewing that again. And and I think it became their number two or number three package product out of Fulton. But then years later, it got dropped. So by the way, I get no credit. I get no royalties. I just want to be clear. You know, I can tell the stories, but I get nothing from Bourbon County Stout or any of it. So,
well, I get think the that's memories. A damn you get the memories, and we appreciate you sharing them with us.
I wouldn't be where I was today if I didn't get to do those things. So
there you go. Well, I was going to say brown ale was popular in that era in a way that more younger listeners may not really clock. This was the era of Pete's Wicked. Like this was a time when people, that was a dominant style, right? Around that time.
Right. Yeah absolutely. Yeah. People were drinking brown ales and, you know, like really bitter hoppy beers were not fashionable at all. You know, like that IPA back then wouldn't be nearly as bitter as some of the West Coast IPAs and things you can get today. But back then people would drink it and be like, ooh, this is so bitter. But you know, if you could fast forward that time machine and taste beers today, it would have been a hearty pale ale, you know?
Yeah, right. Well, let's fast forward the time machine a little bit more to the present day or close. You eventually move on from Goose Island. You're now in, you know, you make your way to Durham. You're still barrel aging, Seth.
Yeah. So I have two breweries here in Durham now. So I missed cooking. And so I really wanted to do that. And so, you know, I learned in college you can live on, you know, burgers and beer. So I opened up Bull City Burger and Brewery. And we, at that time, you know, you got to go back. It's 13 years now. It was, we had big farm tables in there. And, you know, it's like we made people sit together in a communal way and people hated it, right? This is like, I've been influenced by going to Europe and things and like, you know, eating with a bunch of people is fun. And, but we're Americans and like, you got to leave two seats at the movie theater between people. Otherwise you're weird. Right, like if you sit next to somebody, but I opened it up and, you know, we may do grass fed beef and we make everything from scratch. I mean, the buns, the hot dogs, the mayonnaise, the mustard, everything in our restaurants are made from scratch. It's kind of my fine dining background. And then the beer. And so we're brewing beer. And what I knew how to brew was like the Goose Island way, and that I do very authentic traditional beers. So we now brew, our arsenal is about 65 different styles of beer. We do have a lot more IPAs than back, you know, at Goose Island, you just had one, but we never really embraced the whole IPA craze that has happened. And so we often get criticized for that. Like, you know, we only have 8 or 9 beers on tap at a time, but we'll only have one of those maybe be an IPA, occasionally two if one's on the way out and one just got filtered.
Yeah,
and we take a lot of heat for that. Yeah, we take a lot of heat for that. People are like, man, you only have one or two IPAs. Like, what's wrong with your brewery? What, like, do you not know how to brew beer? And I'm like, well, would you like to try one of these 7 or 8 other styles? And they're like, oh, I've never heard of any of those. I'm like, well, that's the point, right? We're almost becoming like preservationists, because if we don't keep brewing ordinary bitters and all these other things, you know, we've won the Brewers Cup in North Carolina. We've won gold medals. But like, if we don't keep doing this, I feel strongly about that, that there's a lot of us who went through the Goose Island mentoring program with Greg that are kind of holding that torch, that we've got to keep these beer styles alive. Otherwise people are only going to know a couple of styles. So, we brew both traditional and we brew kind of Americanized things. So you might get a traditional English porter and then you might get a different porter. All right. So to answer your question more clearly, so I get there and in my mind, I helped launch Bourbon County Stouts. I don't need to do that again. Although nobody in Durham, North Carolina knows I did that, right? Like it wasn't like I was putting this on the wall. So I'm thinking we got to do something different. So we started out, I was getting barrels. We do our barley wine in cognac barrels because I was thinking, you know, wine, cognac, and they're bigger than a whiskey barrel. And so our barley wine every year, we release 3 different versions of a beer. We call it young and horny, old and horny, and then we have kind of a everyday kind of table beer, you know, out of that. So we're doing a traditional brewing process where we do a big barley wine, but then we save that grain and we do a second batch through that. And you drink that young beer while you're waiting for your barley wine to age, right? And so we're doing that tradition. It's called a party guile. So we're doing that traditional brewing technique, aging Some it gets aged for a year in cognac. We did a full year because in the vernacular olden, when you see that, there isn't a legal definition of how long it has to age to be called an olden. But I figured if we do a year, no one can argue. So we do, the barley wine is released as young and horny that year, and half of it goes into cognac and ages a full year and gets released next year. So you can have three choices of horny in every, it's the bull's horns, we're the bull city, that's why it's horny.
Right, right.
So you get these three choices. So we're doing cognac aging. It is fashionable at this point to do bourbon aging. So every
this
now
is
and
about
then.
When? This is about when?
So it goes back 12 years ago. So 2011?
Like 2011, yeah, okay.
Yeah, yeah. So that's when Bull City opened up. So we're doing cognac barrel aging. I'm doing a little bit of bourbon barrel aging because it is fashionable. And you know, but I didn't want to be known as like another bourbon because at that point, everybody's doing bourbon stouts. Like it had mm-hmm. become a thing like IPA is today. So I didn't want to kind of jump on that bandwagon. And yeah. But you would do one and then you couldn't use the barrel again. So I'm like, these barrels are starting to pile up. And I'm like, sure. What are we going to do with these barrels? And I had been to Spain, and down in south in Spain, you have in Jerez, where sherry is made, they have a thing called a solera, where they're aging a pyramid of barrels with wine. And so we started saving these barrels up, and we brewed a Belgian triple, and I started just putting them in these barrels. And this was also totally illegal at the time because I rented like a storage unit and not licensed at all. And I start filling these barrels in a storage unit, no air conditioning, nothing. I wanted the seasonality. So, you know, in North Carolina, these barrels are getting over 100 degrees in the summer and then, you know, down to freezing in the winter. And it's just a metal storage unit. and so we now have 10 barrels. And we start tasting them, and I'm like, ah, these are pretty cool. They're interesting. You get no wood flavor. You're getting like tertiary flavors and maturity and whatever. And it goes on and on, and the barrels are really starting to accumulate. And I finally built a restaurant and a brewery just to house the thing. And so it is a true solera, meaning this pyramid where you've got, you know, two barrels at the top, three barrels at the top, and then four, then five, then six. It looks like a bowling pins, but standing up. It's about 20 feet tall in the air, and we built a restaurant around it. And I think it is the only beer Solera in the world. Now, you got a lot of listeners. And I want someone to verify that because there are places that use that word, but they do not have a traditional Solera.
And show so we us drain, the Solera. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So we drain a little bit off of the bottom row, the 10 barrels at the bottom, a little bit off of that, blend it, carbonate it, put it on tap. The row above it fills in the bottom. The row above that fills in, and new beer goes in the top. And so you have this trickling down over time of beer going through the Solera. You know, when you drink a sherry that says 10 years old, you really do have some sherry in there that's 20, 30, 40 years old, but you have to put the youngest on there. And right now, our Solera is 10 years old.
Wow.
The beer that's in there. Yeah.
That's pretty cool.
It's totally different. Yeah, it's low carbonation, totally different, really weird. Not everybody's getting it, but people who do are like, this is unique. I have never had a beer that tastes like this. So it's kind of a cool thing that only time can handle. So that's what I've done barrel aging now since leaving Goose, is still playing with that stuff. But they've exploded, obviously. I mean, you know, your listeners know that like Goose Island's barrel program is phenomenal, and wine barrels, bourbon barrels, what they do is just great.
Yeah, we had listeners, you may remember, or you may want to go seek it out. We spoke with John Lafler, who was running the Barrel Age program. Seth, I'm assuming you and John probably know each other.
I don't know him, but I listened to that episode, and it was great. He got emotional, right, and I actually want to call him up now and talk to him.
You let me know if you want an introduction. I'd be happy to make one off air, of course. But thank you for the and listener, go check out that episode for sure. Seth, with the remainder of our time, I was hoping, you know, you could maybe reflect for us. You know, you described how no one was doing bourbon aging, and then all of a sudden mm-hmm. everyone was doing it when you moved down to Durham and you opened Bull City. You know, how would you characterize what happens to bourbon barrel aged stouts in the most recent decade, right? So after from 2011 to 2020, where would you sort of contextualize where that program or that style of beer, where it is now, not just at Goose Island, but I mean like in the American craft brewing zeitgeist.
Yeah. I think it's not often that you get to see like the sort of the birth of a style and the evolution of it. And it's kind of cool. Like if someone hasn't done it, they could write a dissertation, you know, and like research this. But, you know, I got to see this like spark become an idea and a style. And then, you know, it's now a category, right? At the in the BJCP or GABF, and like you can win medals now, right? In this. And so to see that kind of growth and become a thing was really, really cool. But then like so many things, two things always seem to happen. One is that people are like, oh yeah, another bourbon stout, whatever. And so they're not really impressed by it anymore. So now breweries have to sort of, how do we express ourselves and appeal to these drinkers, but, you know, stand out in a crowd? Mm. And I think that in a lot of ways, what has happened is that repeated effort has really hurt this industry. And I think we're paying for that right now. But you saw stout bourbon barrels become other types of, you know, let's age it in a sherry barrel, let's age it in wine barrels. And so that's a natural evolution. I think that kind of creativity is great. But then you saw, like, because we got to pump it out, I started seeing, like, we've only aged it for 6 weeks, or we've only aged it for like a month, and we're going to release it it's jagged. It isn't smooth. The corners are there. It isn't rounded. It hasn't had the time in the barrel to really. And I feel like we then had like quality bourbon stouts, and then those who were just sort of capitalizing on the name bourbon stout. And, you know, you saw that. And that happens with everything, you know, that, you know, some people will push out something quicker than it should be because it's a financial constraint or, you know, the desire. And we get into disservice to a lot of folks who, like, you know, drinking this and going, why are people excited about this? And you want to say, like, look, no, it's not a great example of bourbon stout. Like, there are some really nice ones out there. And the base beer is always key, right? You have to have a really good base beer going in there. It doesn't become magic if it went in pretty half-assed. It doesn't come out really delicious. Right. You know, it doesn't get better because the barrel is made it better. But yeah, so it's things like that that I've kind of watched how stouts have evolved. And right now, I think Bourbon County Stout has become, you mentioned it, like you can go to Costco now, I think, and get it. And like it's everywhere. And that's great, but it's also taken some of the mystique out of it, right? But, you know, like making things a little bit more like you had to source them and go to that local bottle shop and be there and get to know folks. I'm not saying it should be allocated and like, you know, traded on the black market for thousands of dollars, but I just mean like as it becomes more ubiquitous, it's really, it takes the magic out of it for me a little bit, you know?
Yeah.
I don't know.
Yeah. No, it's a good point, right? And there's always, I think, that craft brewing in the United States, like many other creative disciplines, whether it's, you know, indie rock or it's sneakers or whatever it is, there's this tension that always exists between sort of the cachet and then the commodity, right? And there's, on one hand, it's great because more people can access Bourbon County Stout and have that experience that you used to have to go down to the Clybourne, you know, pub to get and hope that you were there when you guys had that one barrel on, you know. But on the other, it's like, you do lose some of the specialness, and the specialness as much as is as important as the flavor and the provenance, right? Like there's you know, as you said, the mystique does contribute something to that experience that you can't get back, at least at Goose Island. But I mean, then there's a whole other generation of brewers who came up through Goose Island, like yourself, or Deschutes, or Sierra Nevada, or where, you know, all of the OG, the first waivers, who are doing cool shit like fucking beer Solera's in Durham, North Carolina. So there's it opens up a little bit of space for whatever the next thing is, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that argument is made all the time. It's like, oh yeah, I used to see that band. It was $5 cover when you go in. They're total sellouts now because I have to pay $100 to see them at a bigger arena. It's like, well, you could make that argument. You could also say like they're even better today. But, you know, they've been together longer. They're writing great music, and now more people get to enjoy it, right?
Yeah.
Instead of, you know, $5 cover underground. They were cool then. Now they're sellouts. It's like not necessarily.
Yeah. Yeah. Before I knew him before that. I was drinking it before it was cool. Yeah.
I liked your interview with John. It was great. You can't knock Goose Island. You know, they have done so much for craft beer. I mean, when you look at what Ken Grossman has done and what Fritz Maytag has done, and so many great guys, that Goose Island ranks up there with them. And whether they, you know, got bought or not got bought, I never liked when people knocked it, not just because I worked there. It's like you don't appreciate how you got to drink what's in your glass today, if it wasn't for a handful of brewers that came before, that allows you to drink such good beer today. And you just can't knock them. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. That's, I think, to the extent that Taplines has a, you know, a party line, you know, or an editorial consideration, I think that's more or less where we land here at this show. I mean, I've been reporting on the business for only, you know, whatever, a dozen years, 13 years, far less time than you've been in the business, Seth. But like, you know, that I lived through and reported on the brutal sellout backlash that dominated the discourse. Certainly when Goose Island sold in 2011, when Elysian sells in 2014, 2015. Ugly. Oh, it was brutal. We've had Dick, listener, go check out our episode with Dick Cantwell. He describes people coming into the Seattle brew pubs, ordering a pint and pouring it on the floor to make, he calls them, he always had a great line about it. He called them hate tourists, Seth, which I always got a kick out of. I always thought that was clever.
I hear those arguments. I say to people, like, that's a really naive approach. You know, pick your favorite product. That, like, people are, oh, you know, I use Burt's Bees lotions and everything. It's so cool. It's like, well, they're owned by Clorox, right? So like, you could point to all kinds of products that were, that these people use in their lives every day, not realizing who the parent company is that actually owns that. So I just felt like it was a pretty narrow-minded approach to assume that, you know, it was really bad to see these sellouts.
Yeah. And I, you know, to bring it back to the bourbon aging, bourbon aged stout, this is something that literally, you know, and you know, you can make the argument that if Goose Island doesn't stumble across it again, eventually someone else is going to stumble across it. I don't think it can't be done anywhere else. But the fact of the matter is, it was Greg Hall and Booker No at that dinner in at LaSalle Grill in Indiana. It was Goose Island that, you know, was willing to kind of run this test and then put it on and whatever. And these are things that, you know, someone has to advance that ball. And eventually that person is going to want to retire. And, you know, you've got in most other sectors of American industry, you exit businesses and you sell it to someone else and no one bats an eye, man. That's just the way it works.
Right.
In craft brewing, I think there was a lot of anxiety and apprehension about those sales because some drinkers felt like they had been sold a false bill of goods about independence and about, you know, we're fighting the big guys and hang on, that was the enemy. Why are you selling them? And I, to some extent, I understand those impulses. And I think there's some productive conversation that can come from sort of interrogating those emotions. But yeah, I mean, like some of the backlash was just absurdly over the top, right? Especially for these pioneering firms that were, you know, produced something as enduring as a bourbon barrel aged stout.
Right. Right. I mean, you know, I have a wine background as well, and you saw a lot of these wineries that they sort of set the bar in California and then they had to sell. And it's like people got on them for the same reasons, like, oh, I can't believe they sold out to whatever big brand. Well, you know, the children, if they're going to take it over, the taxes at this point, the value, like there are so many economic considerations beyond just like, you know, thinking that they're just selling out to a big company, their winery.
Right, right.
I mean, the kids could not take it over because they wouldn't be able to afford to keep the winery going because it would just crush them financially. And so they were forced to sell these things. And you see that, you know, happen from time to time. It's just people have a, you know, they're passionate, which is great. That's what makes craft beer great. But they also need to be open to understanding why.
Yeah. Amen to that, man. Yeah. Well, look, Seth Gross, thank you so much for joining Taplines today. It was a pleasure talking about the history of the beginning of bourbon barrel aged stout at Goose Island and your part of it. Thanks so much, my man. You join us anytime, and we appreciate you.
Yeah, absolutely. And I'll send you some beer sometime if you send me your address.
Just to me, listener, not to the rest of you. All right.
Yeah. Just to you. Sorry, I can't send it to everybody.
All right. Take care, Seth.
All right. Thanks, Dave. Bye-bye.
Taplines is recorded in Richmond, Virginia, and produced by yours truly and Darby Seaside, who, along with the talented Shane Farrick, composed our delightful soundtrack. Just listen to it. I also want to give a quick shout-out to the entire Vine Pear team, and especially co-founders Adam Teeter and Josh Mellon, editor-in-chief Joanna Sherino, managing editor Tim McCurdy, and art director Danielle Grinberg, who designed our lovely Taplines logo. And of course, a big thank you to you, yes, you, listener, for spending time with us week in and week out. We literally couldn't do this without you. I'm Dave Infante, and I'll catch you next time.